Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. In 1838, the G.C. Reardon and Company stained glass studio was founded in Cincinnati. Almost 185 years later, in 1983, Jay and Linda Mormon founded the Bovaire Studios and merged with Reardon to form Bovaire Reardon Studios in Middletown, the oldest documented continuously operated stained glass studio in the United States. And joining us now is the owner of the studio, Linda Mormon. Welcome to All Sides, Linda.
Oh, good morning.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the history of this studio? Like, what was a stained glass studio like in 1838 when the original Reardon one was started?
Well, we have all the archives here that we can go through, and my husband tried to make the building that we bought and to make our studio out of. He wanted everything to look like it did back in that period of time. So you would have the beveling area where they made bevel glass for the stained glass windows. It was very, very scary looking to me because there was this great big wheels and stuff. And you know, they don't have the technology that we have today. So it was very crude machines, but they got the job done. There had been, back early on, they only had clear glass that may be colored. And where today they have what they call opalescent glass, where they have color put into the glass and then maybe add some white to get it looking like an opalescent glass. They're just the technology is still the same. They still have glory holes that they melt silica sand, soda ash, and limestone in, and metal oxides to get the different colors. If you ever have a chance to see them make glass, it's pretty cool because it takes at least three men, or maybe women now, I don't know, to make the glass. And that hasn't changed. I know that in Kokomo, Indiana, is where Kokomo stained glass, opalescent stained glass company is. You can go in there and watch them, and it's pretty interesting to see what's going on. When one guy's at one glory hole and another guy's at another glory hole, maybe two different colors, and they go across the room real fast and throw it on this table, and a guy mixes it up and then pushes it onto a table that pushes through to pushes the molten glass through to make it flat on the other side, and then they push it into another area to cool it.
Wow.
So that stuff has not changed one iota. It's still the same.
Wow. Yeah, that makes me want to look up a video now of how glass is made. I've never even thought about it before. But can you take me to 1983? Like, why did you and your husband decide that you wanted to start a stained glass studio?
Well, he started it as a hobby, and he became addicted to it.
Hmm.
And
you came along for the ride?
Well, yeah, we got married, and I got pregnant, and I said, you have to get the lead out of our house.
Oh,
so
I see.
He made a studio in our garage, and he did that for a while, and he's always begging me, please let me quit my job. I can do this. I know I can do this. And so finally I said, okay, well, you can have somebody rent it during the day. You can do it at night, but you can't quit your job. So we took this place in a strip mall and started it and opened. And within, I don't know, it was 3 weeks or something, he quit his job on me and didn't tell me. I wasn't too happy.
Well,
but he did it.
Yeah.
And it's worked. And then seemed like right out the gate, it was like 3 months into us having the studio out in the strip mall, we got a call from the Islamic Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's the biggest job still to date that we've ever done. And I just went there recently and I was like, I can't believe we did that. Oh my God, that is so beautiful. Because of the style of glass we use. And it's been a pleasure doing this, but we're also getting old and we're thinking about retiring soon, but it's hard to walk away.
Well, tell me about the name, Beauvert. Is that French?
So, yes, it means beautiful glass.
Hmm, okay.
And that was back in the day when we had, you want to be first in the telephone book?
Oh.
So we had a gentleman that was going to partner with us, and his name was Avante, and we had Beauvert. So when he backed out, we just went straight with the Beauvert instead of the Avante and Beauvert mixed.
Okay. And then at what point did you decide to merge with Reardon?
Oh, I couldn't tell you a date.
Mm.
I was in my 40s, and I'm in my 70s now, so it's been a long time ago. I can't remember.
That's okay. But you've shared there's a rich history behind the studio. There are works from the company in landmarks across Cincinnati. I mean, how does it feel for you and your husband to be a part of Cincinnati history with all of the stained glass?
It's pretty cool. My husband is a Cincinnati boy. He comes from Cincinnati. And I lived here in Middletown, Ohio. And he had to come my way because if we had kids, it was closer for me to be to the kid rather than him. But it's really cool because, I mean, Cincinnati is such a cool city anyway. And you know, the arts were all coming that way out of like West Virginia stuff. There was like a great... I don't know. I know the word to use. People started moving in that direction towards Cincinnati for the arts because there's so much. You got Rookwood and some other things that you know, the stained glass studios they had there was, of course, Reardon, which G.C. Reardon came to the United States to become a painter and a sculptor. And he went to the Ohio Mechanics College, which is now part of the University of Cincinnati. So he came and you go forward years later, there was a young man by the name of Walter Baumbach that his father took him to a monastery to keep him out of a concentration camp. It's back when Tito was putting people in concentration camps. And he said to the monks, can you give my son a job? And they said, sure. So they put him in the stained glass studio. And in 1955, G.C. Reardon heard about Walter and got him to come to the United States. And Walter was the predecessor before us.
Wow. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the Beauvert Reardon Studios with owner Linda Moorman. Can you tell me a little bit about your retail offerings? If a visitor comes to your studio, what can they expect to find and what can they buy?
Stained glass tools to start the project and glass of all different colors. We don't carry everything, but we carry a lot.
Mm. And the stained glass shown on your website, I mean, it's beautiful. Some of it is ornate glass, as the kind you tend to see in historic homes, you know, homes of a certain era. Some are more artistic window treatments. Does this style remain popular no matter how tastes change? Does everyone love stained glass still?
Yes. Yeah, people walk in here and they throw their hands up to their chest and go, oh, my God, it's so beautiful in here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes us feel good to hear that because it's so inspiring. It's like, I don't know if you've ever sat in a church with stained glass windows and the lights coming through. It makes you feel like grace. It just makes you feel all warm and fuzzy when the light comes through and you see all the different colors.
Yeah.
That glass didn't come into play until the late, somewhere in the early 1900s. Before that, they only had clear or cathedral glass, like red, blue, and green, and they had to stain or paint it to get the different colors. And then they invented opalescent glass next, which was the cathedral glass with white glass mixed in, and then they mixed it up. And so it's more translucent than transparent.
Hmm. Do you get hired to do projects that are restoring stained glass, or do you make new stuff from scratch most of the time?
We do both.
How does it feel to go into some, like, you know, I don't know, maybe an old church or something like that, and see stained glass that needs a little tender loving care and fix it up? How does that make you feel?
It's like, you know, the churches and the restoration, I think, has got us through all of our hard times, because there's so much of it out there that needs restored. So, you know, over time, the lead starts stretching and then the glass kind of starts falling out. And so we have about three churches in here right now that we're restoring their glass. We take it all the way. We make a rubbing of it, just like you used to do tombstones. And so you have to, because we have no pattern to work from. So we make a rubbing of that window, and then we start disassembling it. We do it all underwater because of we don't want to breathe lead. So back in the day, they used to put red lead in the putty. Mm. The putty is what goes around everything, and so we make sure that we're not exposing ourselves. And the ladies that work here, they put their mask on and just make sure they do all the things proper to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. When you repair it now, I'm guessing you use a different technique. You don't need to use red lead.
Yeah, we have a different way of puttying. Yeah. But basically, it's still the same way. You know, you got to make a rubbing, take it apart, put it back together, solder it, putty it. It's a very long process. But we are repairing windows that are over 100 years old.
Mm, yeah.
That's longevity.
Yes, definitely. And then your windows will last another 100 years?
Absolutely. Or more.
Or more. All right. And you offer classes too, or like workshops. You want to teach the next generation of stained glass lovers, right?
We do. We do. In fact, quite a few of our employees have come out of our classroom. They decide they like it that much, and we hire them.
Wow, that's great. Is it a difficult skill to learn, or does it just take patience, or is there a certain type of person who works with stained glass?
I think when I've actually been in the classroom teaching for a few years, I only ever had one person that just walked away and said, I don't like this at all.
Okay. So it can be for everyone. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but most of it, I know last night we have a group of sisters that's dad did stained glass, and he's going to give his stained glass tools and glass over to them to start making beautiful things at home. And we have all different people that come and want it, and mostly half of the class or more comes back and takes more classes.
So for those sisters who want to do what their dad did, but maybe they want to learn from you, the experts, so they know they're doing it right.
Yes, it does help, especially when there's some glasses that are tougher to cut than others.
So you mentioned earlier you've been doing this for quite a while now. Do you have plans for the future of the studio to keep the legacy alive?
We're trying to find somebody that would like to take it over and love it like us and our forefathers have loved it. Yes, we would. We don't want it to just close out. We want it to keep going.
Okay, so you're looking for someone who can love the stained glass and keep the studio going, but you haven't found that person yet?
Yes, correct. So if any of your listeners out there are interested, they should give us a call, because it's so rewarding and it's so pretty just sitting in here, and it's inspiring. And you know, the stained glass windows tell stories to people. Like back in the hundreds of years ago, they had no way to teach the peasants their Bible stories, so they taught them through stained glass windows.
Oh wow,
they'd make a scene. You know, like if you go to churches, you'll see multiple scenes, like if it's St. John's, multiple things about St. John's, or multiple things about Jesus in different windows. So, but they were learning tools, and they still are today. But you know, people don't even look; they just accept that it's there and they don't think about it. So, I had a thing here in town where we put a bunch of people together, and we went to all the different churches, and you know, all these people went in these churches all these years. They didn't know that was what that story was on that stained glass window in their church. So That's kind of a cool part when you go in and you see the different windows and different techniques, different styles of painting. That does change over the years, the different type of, the drawings we do are called cartoons. So they will do a scale drawing, a cartoon, because it may be, let's say, 24 by 36, but in reality in the church, they may be 10 times that because of the big tall windows. And it's awesome to go in a new church and see the windows. And I wish I could. I'm not talented. I can make a stained glass window. I cannot stain or paint. I know how, but I don't have the myself. I'm not a good artist drawing.
Well, I
can make it, but I can't draw it.
Well, I hope someone listening to this takes the time the next time they're in a church or a place with a stained glass window and takes a closer look at it. Maybe you probably inspired them to do so. And I wish you luck. I hope you find someone to take over the studio and love it like you do.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking about the Beauvair Reardon Studios with owner Linda Moorman. The studio is the oldest documented, continuously operated stained glass studio in the United States. Linda, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. For more than 70 years, American architect Frank Lloyd Wright designed everything from homes in Wisconsin to entire hotels in Tokyo. Over half a century after his death, one of those homes sits in none other than Springfield, Ohio, the Westcott House. Our next Fascinating Ohio guest is the dedicated curator, Marta Wojcik. She is full of passion for the architecture and the art that Wright himself was known for. Welcome to All Sides, Marta.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for those who don't know or maybe are just not super familiar, tell me a little bit about who Frank Lloyd Wright was and why his work is so renowned nowadays.
Well, you know, we like to say, and I think it's true, that even if someone is not necessarily interested or much aware of architecture, Frank Lloyd Wright is a name that most people recognize. His work is really around the United States. It's so well recognized. And it's really, I think, tribute to how many public sites that were perhaps originally a home, family home, just like the Westcott House was, that eventually were turned into a site that is really dedicated now for the public enjoyment. So there are so many of them around the country. And, you know, even architects who are, I think, sometimes hesitant to name the best among them, they did recognize Frank Lloyd Wright as the most important American architect. So Besides, also on the international level, in 2019, the 20th century architecture of Franklin Wright was inscribed into World Heritage list. So that tells us that it's really an American contribution to the world heritage.
So let's talk about Springfield's part in this. Why is it called the Westcott House? Why does it have that name?
This is because of this incredible family that decided at the time that it wasn't necessarily given that this would be a success. They reached out to Frank Wright and decided to have a house designed by him. Westcott family, Burton and Orpha, they came to Springfield in early 1900s, and this was the place to be in terms of how much was happening at the time in this city. It was really an incredible place full of innovation. So it was kind of fitting that they decided to do something different and create this beautiful home that is still recognized as something quite unusual. Whenever you pass by, you can see there is something quite different about it.
Yeah. So for our radio listeners, what is unique about the Westcott House? What makes it so special?
And it's just such a radical departure from everything that people were used to. Frank Lloyd Wright really got active in 1890s. You started seeing these unusual lines and quite different approach to the design of a home. And Westcott really is that incredible example of prairie style home. You can see these striking horizontal lines that really are quite emphasized. There are bands and bands of windows. There are these oversized urns in front of the house that are really, really striking. So the proportions and the use of materials and how the house is positioned, you just can't be, you can't help but pay attention. And he was really good about creating houses and buildings that people truly paid attention to.
Yeah, we'll get into a little bit about how it needed renovations and all of that. But the Westcott House, as it is now, has been open as a museum and an art center for about 20 years. How did you celebrate that 20-year anniversary this past year?
Oh, in so many different ways, because we're really ever since we opened to the public, our mission is not only to make the house available for guided tours, and that is possible due to, we have, I think, 102 volunteers right now that are really active, passionate, and they come from all around the region. People come from Columbus, Cincinnati, Dayton to give tours because they recognize this house as quite unique for the state. And so besides the tours, though, we do all kinds of educational programming. We really want to be a community hub for the community that really needs that type of awareness, needs that type of engagement. And so we definitely serve that role. And, we have all kinds of events. Ever since we opened, we experiment quite a bit. Mm. So we have film screenings in the garden. We have intimate concerts. We have contemporary artists displaying art in the house on occasion. We have also programs for youth that are focused, for example, on multimedia exploration. So it's really the place has become full of life. And the 20th anniversary was marked by a number of special tours and programs. Among them, there was an event with a great granddaughter of Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm. This is the beauty of this place, that we can connect with many amazing people across the country. So her background is design, so it was really wonderful to connect with the family this way.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Springfield's Westcott House with Marta Wojcik. Let's talk about you for a minute. What got you interested in art and architecture?
Well, I graduated. I got my master's in Poland, in Krakow, Poland. Krakow is recognized as one of those amazing places in terms of art history. So I was really quite fortunate to grow up in Krakow and got really interested in art and art history while growing up there. But I ended up coming to Chicago. That's where my family was. And I immediately got awestruck by the Chicago architecture, the early skyscrapers, which then led me to, of course, down the path. Of course, I had to visit Frank Lloyd Wright home and studio in Oak Park. And it was just so impactful. I just was naturally drawn to his architecture. But I had no clue I'm going to end up in Springfield, Ohio, helping to lead this amazing, iconic house. This was definitely the one of the interests, even in my college years. I was fascinated by American architecture and art. It was just really quite different than what I was used to.
So if you're in Chicago and you're looking at all the skyscrapers, I mean, connect that to Springfield of all places for me. How did you end up with your career here in Springfield?
Well, it was, I consider it quite a lucky coincidence. I was in Chicago. I got involved at the Art Institute of Chicago, and they have an incredible department dedicated to architecture and design. And I was really lucky to become intern there, and I was mentored by the founder of that department. So it was just incredibly fortunate for me. And then I heard of the opportunity here, and I was already volunteering for Home and Studio. I was giving tours of Wright Home, and I was also giving tours of Chicago architecture, of actually early skyscrapers. I went through the program with Chicago Architecture Center. So I definitely developed a deeper understanding of this, of both sides of the big city, big skyscrapers, and also the residential architecture. So when this opportunity came up, it was really quite unique, because this house, it doesn't happen anymore, really, that you discover this Frank Lloyd Wright house that was somewhat forgotten, mm-hmm. partly because of its tragic history of, just changes that it went through. And toward the end, in around 2000, it was in really poor shape. So everyone was concerned that if whether this house would even survive another decade, right? So, but everyone rallied around, and as a result, there was the house went from private hands into a nonprofit, and with the help of the national organization, Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy. So the house was saved and restored. And that's how, I got involved as a curator of the place when we first opened to the public, which was really quite overwhelming at first, I must admit.
I can't believe the house was nearly lost to history. So in that time when it was in disrepair, like prior to being in disrepair, someone along the way did a remodel of it, and they made alterations to the interior space. They got rid of all of the open concept, put up walls. So your team had to work to basically put it back to the way it was. Was that the goal?
Yes, it was an extremely complex puzzle. The house was, after World War II, it was divided into apartments, and that was really common back then due to housing crisis and these large houses. It's a pretty large house, so it kind of made sense, honestly. I don't know if after World War II, if this was not done, who knows what would happen to this large building. But that changed dramatically how the house looked inside and outside. And of course, over time, people just lost kind of touch with how the house originally looked. So it was like slowly losing its authenticity, right? And so when they started restoration, the team did incredible job of just going back to primary resources. And what made this restoration possible was discovery of the original drawings. So there were still a pretty comprehensive set of drawings that showed floor plans, elevations, even even furniture pieces that were, you know, that were long gone. So this made the restoration possible. And between that and some, you know, some stories from people who used to live even, you know, in apartments over the years, they all this was collected. There were a few.
Well, it looks like Marta froze for a second there. So maybe we will turn off the video. That might help if we can get her back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Fascinating Ohio. We are talking about Springfield's Westcott House with Marta Wojcik. Are you there, Marta?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Just maybe turn off your video if you can do that for a second, because then that'll help with our bandwidth situation here. Yes. Okay. Well, why don't we pivot to, do you have a favorite part of the Westcott House when you're giving a tour? Do you have a favorite part? Are you there, Marta? Uh-oh. Okay.
Well, I'm not sure what's happening.
Yeah. Okay, there you are. Go ahead. Do you have a favorite part?
I just think that, you know, everyone is drawn to some of the key aspects of the house, such as the skylight. And there are so many beautiful rooms that are, the house by itself, by the very definition of how Frank Littrate approached it, is just really a harmonious whole, right? So you go from place to place, you just flow from one design feature to another, and it all makes sense. And I think that's why people have this intuitive reaction to the house, even if they're not necessarily prepared to love the house. They go through and they discover that it has incredible effect on you know, on our mental state, on how we start to look at our surroundings. It's a really incredible masterclass in how people should aspire to really live.
Can you tell us when the house is open to the public? Do you need an appointment to get a tour, or can you just show up?
Ideally, people would go to westcotthouse.org, because we do have an online ticketing system, and it's a naturally kind of intimate experience, right? We have guides that take people on a tour of the house, and typically the tour is about an hour and a half, and it's a group of 10 to 12 people who experience the house in that kind of setting. So it's really, really, we always advise to make plans and to also check out other places around Springfield as well, because there's a lot to explore, really.
You also do work with a group called Creative Ohio. It's a statewide advocacy group that's focused on the creative economy. Can you tell me what you're hoping to try to accomplish with your work through this group?
Well, I was lucky enough to participate in their Leadership Institute last year. It is a statewide organization that is dedicated to
All right. Well, unfortunately, we have a bad connection with Marta, so I think we're going to have to leave it there. But she is a member of the Advocacy Leadership Institute.
We basically we went around the state and explored different places, and from, you know, Toledo to Dayton, we're just working together as a team to get.
Okay, well, I think that the internet is failing us today, and I apologize for that. But we've been talking about Springfield's Westcott House, a Frank Lloyd Wright house, with its curator, Marta Wojcik. And we really appreciate her time today. Marta, if you are still there and can hear me, thank you so much for your time. And coming up, we are going to learn about a community care class through cuddling. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Loom Collective just opened in Clintonville. It's a community center focused on providing connection and touch to those deprived of it. Almost every week, they host platonic cuddling classes, along with massage workshops and occasional book clubs. Founder and licensed massage therapist Christy Holtzclaw joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Christy.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is the first time I'm hearing about a place like Loom Collective. Tell me where the idea came from.
It really just came from lived experience. Partially, you know, there are existing communities, whether they're happening in, you know, small sort of private spaces throughout the country. There's organizations like Cuddle Party that host and facilitate platonic connection events, but there's really not necessarily a space where there's an ongoing community. And this need really just came out organically. I found myself in some cuddly spaces around Columbus, spaces where people were accessing platonic touch. Although I appreciated those spaces, I was also finding that, you know, I was needing more safety. I was needing more nuance around communication, around consent, around a trauma-informed framework. And so this Loom Collective was kind of created to both meet the need of connection that I was feeling that so many people have felt, especially post-COVID, as we all spend so much time on our phones and attached to tech devices, but at the same time, really bringing layers of thoughtfulness around the communication and consent pieces so that it's as safe as possible.
So cuddling parties are something that have been happening in Columbus. And so that's something that you experienced, but you decided to make it more, I don't want to use the word more serious, but so you're making it more, more structured. Is that what you're doing?
Well, there are some spaces that do have that kind of structure. I think what differentiates what we're doing at Loom, one is that it's a recurring community space. A lot of the places that exist right now or pop-up events, they're a pop-up. And so the skills that we need to learn, I guess, in relationship to provide safe platonic connection to one another, it's just like any other relationship skill. It takes practice. And so what we do is having these recurring opportunities so that we can actually learn in a community environment, knowing that we're, you know, even if we have the most structured framework, we are going, you know, we're all human beings. And so there are parts of this that are going to be difficult. We're going to need to not only navigate touch, but also navigate our own communication challenges, learning how to hold ourselves and one another accountable without shame, developing skills around relational repair. And the community aspect of that with these recurring events facilitates that in a way that's different from if I go to an event one time and I don't necessarily see those folks ever again.
So your website mentions that the name Loom is a metaphor for connecting people together. Tell me more about that and how you came up with the name. Why Loom?
Yes, it really is a nod to weaving a fabric of community. There is an interesting thing. I mean, I think my own relationship to touch, touch has helped me heal as a person. Part of that was in massage school. Part of that was through having community spaces where I've been able to access healthy touch. But the thing about it is, even though it's been as personally profound as has been for me, it's linked tremendously to community. It's liberation is relational in that sense of like, we are only healthy and able to thrive in our own selves insofar as we're able to do that together. And so the loom metaphor really is this visual metaphor. And we have an actual loom that one of our community members created as we're kind of weaving the fabric of community. That's kind of the idea, is that we as individuals come together to create something that's stronger, because it really is about, it's not just about touch and connection in a moment. It's how do we create a safe space for people to find one another and have a strength of a community.
And I mentioned that you're newly open in Clintonville. Like, how new are we talking? When did you get started?
Our first public event was last November. So we did have a group of folks that were gathering informally for about a year prior to that. And it was, last November that we did our first event in Clintonville. And we host events regularly since then. Like you said, almost every week.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the space that you have? Is it like a studio? Is it a lot of small rooms? Is it one big room? Explain your space to me.
Yeah, it's one big room, and we're subleasing a space that's used by Dave by another massage therapist. And we use the space. We kind of keep all of our materials in a side closet, and then Sunday evenings come and we transform the space. We have just one large room. And what we use is we use a number of padded floor type materials to create a soft surface. We have soft blankets, cushions. We have low lighting, soft music, and really create this full sense, multi-sensory relaxation environment, because it is a space to find connection, but it's also really a space for rest. And it's intended to be first a space where someone could come in and feel calm and at ease and safe. And then if they want to engage in connection with other people, they're able to do that. We do have a little bit of partition in the space so that folks can maybe head to a different area. Like there's a couch that's kind of separate from the main cuddle area, so folks can opt in to each space as they feel comfortable. But yeah, right now we're kind of in one main room that we put together, and take down every time we have an event.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the Loom Collective with founder Christy Holtzclaw. So your website says that cuddling is never required. You say participation includes a cuddle pile, one-on-one closeness, feet-to-feet only, sitting nearby with snacks, or solo nesting on a pillow. And then it says agency is central here. So tell me more about that. So there's different ways to participate.
100%. Touch is something that a lot of us might have curiosity about, a desire to connect in a space where maybe we don't, right? We don't necessarily have that connection in other spaces. And so there are a lot of folks that are drawn to spaces like this, and I would count myself among them, as recently as a couple of years ago, where I'm interested and also terrified, right? Like, what do you mean I'm going to get in a room with a bunch of people I don't know, and we're going to be cuddling? That's a really big leap for a lot of us. And so Loom is a space where we offer that. And it's never an expectation, right? No one's going to know how they feel about connecting with other people until they're in the space. And it takes time, right, to acclimate to a new space, to acclimate to new folks. And so the agency being central is just the core of everything that we do at Loom, because that is how we are upholding each other's dignity. That's how we uphold respect. We set the whole framework for our community is through that agency piece. And yeah, we affirm that all the way. Folks are very welcome to just come and take it in. Observation is a valid way of participating. We do have snacks. One of our main events is Cuddles and Snacks, just to be very literal with the naming. We do have snacks at all of our events, and folks are welcome to come and connect socially, through words. We don't monitor people's. We try to keep a quiet and kind of nurturing space, but folks are encouraged to engage in conversation as ways to connect, because that can be a bridge to connection, or maybe that's the only way that someone wants to connect. So it's really, we offer a menu, so to speak, of ways to connect platonically with other people, and touch and cuddling is just one of those ways.
What about for a first timer? So, if someone signs up for a cuddle session, what should they expect? Walk me through what's going to happen.
Absolutely. So for first timers, we definitely recommend checking out Intro to Cuddling, which happens the first Sunday of every month from 6 to 10. And Intro to Cuddling is our facilitated event. And it's a 4-hour event. About 3 hours of that is a workshop where we walk through everything. We walk through our cuddle agreements to make sure we're all on the same page about how we're going to show up and behave in the space. We also go through several consent related and communication related exercises so that we can start building a practice around maybe, tuning in to one's own individual desires, learning how to communicate that to one another, also learning how to navigate a feeling of ambivalence. Maybe I want to connect with someone, but I have a fear around that. So we provide some tools that people can use to negotiate down to something that feels really clear and like they want to step into that. For that event, we also have at the end about an hour of unstructured time where folks are welcome to cuddle if they want to. We also have conversation cards and these touch cards is what they're called, where they're a bit of a conversation card with a touch related prompt so that there is a bit of a structure if someone wants to engage in touch. And maybe they don't know anyone, that's a self-guided tool that they can use. So intro to cuddling really is our most supportive option for people that are new. And we also offer the cuddles and snacks, which that is the framework of those events is very, it's much more unfacilitated, or what I like to say is community facilitated. We all hold the space together. We do those on the second and fourth Sundays of the month from, again, from 6 to 10. We do an opening circle at the beginning where we again review all of our agreements so that we are holding a safe space for everyone that's there. But then it's completely unstructured the rest of the time. So folks can grab a snack. And part of that, there is discomfort in that for a lot of folks, of like, okay, I'm in this space. How do I, what is that, how am I supposed to show up? How do I navigate this? And so we have facilitators, myself included, to help support people through that. And again, without ever having an expectation for people to engage in a certain way. They're always welcome. People are always welcome to come and check it out, and engage as they feel comfortable. And it may be, maybe it takes some time to develop that comfort. But we're all in it together, and navigating that discomfort is part of the journey. And so we're here to support people in that.
What do you tell someone who finds the concept to be weird or unusual whenever you tell someone what kind of studio you run?
Right. Yeah, that does happen. So I think there's a few things. One is I think there is not a lot of framework in our society for healthy platonic touch, especially among adults. We have a framing where maybe we access touch in a sexual relationship, a romantic relationship, or maybe we have it when we hire someone for a massage, but we don't have this framework. And yet, as humans, we have this need. We have a need physiologically to co-regulate our nervous systems. Our bodies, young people, right, as for people that are still developing, bodies do not will not grow as healthily if they don't have access to human touch. And so we validate this need for children, for example, but we kind of stop validating it as we grow older. But our need remains the same. And so this is really, it is different than a lot of us have had framing around touch before. But really, I like to tell people it really is as wholesome as it seems, in the sense that like we are accessing, supporting space for people to access that true need that they have for touch, for co-regulation, and really for acceptance in an inclusive social space. This is a space for everyone to feel valid. And I think that need is true for all of us. We kind of lack a greater societal framework to acknowledge those needs as valid and for meeting them, outside of romantic relationships in particular.
And we only have about a minute left, but I know you're a new business, the Loom Collective, but do you have plans to add more things, expand? What's your 1 year plan, 5 year plan? But we only have a minute.
Yep, absolutely. So we are looking to expand into a space that's a full-time space. Hopefully, actually, that could happen in the next couple of months. And also having events every week where there's always a drop-in event and then offering additional specialized events for certain groups. And going from there, expanding just based on what the community is saying that, that is valuable. So definitely have expansion plans coming up this year.
We have been talking about the importance of touch, and we have been talking about having cuddle sessions with the founder of the Loom Collective, who is also a licensed massage therapist. We've been talking with Christy Holtzclaw. Christy, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for telling me about your new business.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And you've been listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you, and that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
Weekday mornings from 5 until 9 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the OSU Steam Factory, presenting Weird Science and Whiskey Live, hosted by The Third Pattern, a nonprofit dedicated to making science accessible and engaging. This casual night out.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.